and welcome back to Safe Space, the Safe in Our World podcast. For those who don't know, the main goal of Safe in Our World is to create and foster worldwide mental health awareness within the video games industry. My name is Rosie, and today I am joined by Dr. Matthew White, who is the CEO of White Thorn Games, as well as Sky from Safe in Our World. Hi. I realised I hadn't added you into my intro, Sky, and I was like, well, I need to let them know that you're here as well. But yeah, hi. thank you so much for being on the podcast, Matt. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Happy to be here anytime.
Amazing. So I wanted to kick off basically because you've been in the industry for a number of years now. And that included also working as an assistant teaching professor at Penn State University.
Yes.
And I just wanted to kind of ask you about your journey into where you are now as a CEO, but also like how you got into games and the pathway that you chose to take.
Yeah, that's a complex, I think that's a complex zigzaggy path. I always, had a thing for games since I was a little kid. Grew up with playing Miss Pac-Man and going to arcades and things like that. And I mean, I'm a little bit older, I guess, for games. Certainly not old by any stretch of the imagination, but I guess I'm like hockey old or football old, where you're like, oh God, he's 36, dinosaur. But anyway, it was those kinds of Super Nintendo and Nintendo moments, I think, that really made my kind of childhood. I was raised by my mom and sister to some extent. My dad died when I was very little. I think they naturally gravitated towards stuff that they could play with me. And dad was more the game player, but he unfortunately lost his life in the early 90s, cancer. Mom and my sister didn't play so much. So I was a child, like 3, 4. So they gravitated towards stuff that they could play easily with me. So we got a lot of like Harvest Moon and things like that. And so to me, I guess, I played the competitive stuff, but the kind of squishier, slower stuff was more naturally game-like to me. You know, I played Zelda on the Game Boy and things. And anyway, those kinds of experiences meant a lot to me. And I think I always just thought about games as some way to express creative ideas. And I thought that was interesting. So my schooling was always some kind of creative enterprise. So I did dramatic theater, like English Renaissance drama for my undergrad, taught drama at high school for a little bit, computer science as well. Then I took a master's degree in education and studied education in my PhD as well. But what I studied was like audio uses in cueing. So like how audio sounds cue people's attention. Thing about PhDs is they're very, very specific. So that sounds like unbelievably particular, and that's because it is. But they're always like that. It'll be like, I study one particular ear bone in one particular fish in one particular river in one part of the world. Like your PhD is always extremely specific and the learning is more general. But anyway, because I was studying use of audio and use of cueing, it became really, at the time, there wasn't a degree called HCI, like human computer interaction. But that was becoming a thing in games, usability and user research and user testing. So I was at one of the first meetings of the Games User Research SIG of the IGDA a million years ago when I was still a grad student. And now that's big and thriving. They have their own conference. We employ a user researcher here. So I kind of tethered my boat to that much larger ship when I was graduating. Did work at Volition on the Saints Row games. Did usability and user analytics. I had that statistics background from the grad school, so I think that I sort of naturally gravitated toward more mathematical quantitative stuff. Did data work for PlayStation and then also for Keyword Studios. And eventually just got, I think, a little frustrated that I'd gotten so far from games. I spent a lot of time looking at databases and spreadsheets and this kind of thing, but I didn't really get any of the creative enterprise that was the reason I got into the thing in the first place. And I think that's what made me want to take a stab at this enterprise. We put White Thorn together in 2017. I was working at Keywords at the same time. They're in Ireland and I worked remotely. So it let me kind of do both sides of the clock. Yeah. And I mean, here we are now. We have about 30 employees, 29 games, sitting in our office. So we're doing okay so far.
Doing more than okay, I think. It's amazing.
It's funny in games because there's really only like 4 or 5 enterprises, truly, maybe a few more, that are really super stable. Like, I mean, that'll never go anywhere. But a lot of indies are riding on the edge of a knife a lot of the time. I mean, even us, I mean, we're certainly a big indie, but we by no means are just sitting on bags and bags of money or anything. So it's a very, it's a different life. You're not publicly traded. You don't have trillions of dollars of investor interest to draw on if things go poorly or if things go well. It's different. And I like that challenge.
I think it's really impressive how much you've done. I mean, mere minutes ago, you were saying, you know, I'm halfway through my 30s. I'm so old for the industry. And then you list off, you know, probably a couple lifetimes worth of achievements, you know.
It's just anxiety disorder. If I slow down, I have to look inward, and that's terrifying.
God, that's a mood.
Oh, no, that's so awesome. And I mean, it's, I think the industry specifically is very much built on passion, which is why so many people are so open to the idea of being very in a financially vulnerable situation as well by, you know, going for their dream job, and it might not work out, but it might be amazing. And I think a lot of people are like, you know what, it's worth it. It's worth to do it.
I'm pleased that it's worked out okay for me. And we have had few, not none, but few instances in my career where I've had that kind of like, oh, you're passionate about this, time to work 90 hours a week kind of scenario. And we do our best not to do that to people here. I mean, certainly games is cyclical, so there are moments of overtime and the like right before games come out, but we don't have the kind of systemic crunch that you're used to. I literally wrote a book about it, how little I am pleased with that entire phenomenon. Seems odd to me that an industry whose net product is joy should grind its workers so badly. But yeah, anyway, I'm not. I have pretty open and public opinions on that.
Yeah.
So do we. Right. I feel like this is the perfect conversation for this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's been a long time here. It's I'm kind of pivoting because I want to let you lead on questions, but I have this habit of just kind of going, and I don't want to dominate your time too.
Oh, no, I have a habit of just letting people, I just like listening and seeing where they go with things. So
No. I mean, I love PlayStation, and I mean, not pointing any fingers, every major AAA company is guilty of this in one way or another. You're beholden to a release cycle, right? Like, I mean, you're a publicly traded company. Investors have you in their retirement funds. Like, it is critical that you continue to make your product. There's this common kind of knee-jerk sentence that people will say sometimes in games that like, you know, there's low criticality, meaning if we make an error, a plane doesn't fall out of the sky or a cancer drug doesn't come out that kills people. You know, like what we're doing doesn't have grave consequences if we make screw-ups. Like the worst we get is a nasty Steam review, right? And so what that means is typically like, well, it should be a pretty chill kind of place to work. You know, you're not worrying about like, I'm a criminal defense lawyer. My client might be wrongfully put in prison for life. Like, you know, you don't have these very high stakes kind of things. But I think there's a bit of a falsehood there for the large companies because at least in AAA, I mean, Microsoft's share returns and Sony's share returns mean and Nintendo's meaningfully affect like the retirement health and safety of millions and millions and millions of people. So there's still like an active stress to be like, we got to get it out. The name, the brand, the company has to stay strong, you know. And so any AAA enterprise that has public reporting duties, I mean, has an additional layer of pressure on them that's not necessarily visible from the outside in order to drive performance. And I think that's just kind of capitalism sucking in the way that it normally does, because that's not just true of games. It's true of Pepsi and BP, and it doesn't matter. If you're managing something that people have hitched their inflation hedge against, you need to manage it perfectly or people go bankrupt. So it can be very heady and stressful. And so what ends up happening is executives push that stress downward, right? Because it's on their necks, and then they'll push it to their managers, and their managers will push it to their employees and so forth. And what's unique about games, I think, is that it's easy to hook people on passion, right? Like, I've always wanted to do this. And so it's just enough entertainment industry that there's sort of that, like, you know, kind of Disney-esque, like, well, you want to be a star, don't you? Then stay here until 3 o'clock in the morning and work until your eyes bleed. Like, my bosses were occasionally pretty quick to remind me that, like, oh, you're punching out at 7, huh? I remember when we interviewed 30 other people for your job kind of thing. And it's like, you know, so you had those sort of moments of like, oh, I better stay another hour or two. And anyway, that kind of presenteeism never really sat right with me. If the work's done, I leave. Like, it's I mean, I have tasks to accomplish. I accomplish them, and then I go hang out with my kids. But they get accomplished. It's just nobody's here like, oh, you're done by 3? Well, work doesn't end till 5, so you better find something to do. Like, that whole thing is just, there's lots of little micro things that contribute to an overall picture of you know, not a healthy work environment for people. So we try our best here to be founded on those ideas. I think this kind of pivots a little into your kind of next one of your other questions about the company generally. Mm-hmm. Founded the company on the idea that, you know, we're oversaturated with the ability to run down a hallway and shoot people, and that we should have kind of other options. And I know there's a bit of a false narrative there because obviously there are other games, you know, Animal Crossing and so forth. But really, we wanted the company's entire ethos to be founded on the idea that games ought to be infinitely and endlessly approachable. So approachability is actually our piece. People will say like cozy games, things like that. And we've never necessarily said that's our brand. Certainly there's a fit there because they tend to have the same goals that we do. But you'll see like a environmental thriller from us coming up shortly. You know, we have games like We Should Talk that are deal with sort of uncomfortable relationship situations that can be a little bit heady and heavy. There's not necessarily anything in our brand pitch that says like we're going to always be publishing something squishy and cute. I think people have just started to maybe associate us with that because we have several very successful squishy and cute titles. But really, it's about approachability. Anybody, anywhere, grandma to toddler, should be able to pick up our game and play it quickly and feel as though they have a high level of mastery and agency in seconds. And that's really the key is easiness, ease, approachability and ease. So our audience tends to be kids, like 13 and under, and adults like 25 and up. So we seem to have this straddle over the sort of traditional gamer demographic where we kind of miss, you know, like 17 to 22 and angry. And I mean, good. Like it's not the worst kind of audience to miss. So that's been very nice, actually. But that speaks to the fact that those two audiences don't necessarily have games catered directly toward their needs. Obviously, the younger audience is dominated by Nintendo. They're all familiar with Nintendo products, and so we do very well on the Switch with that group. And the older audience tends to be very heavy on PC and mobile devices for us. We do well on the other consoles as well. It's just those tend to be our flagships.
So do you think because you've kind of opted for like you said, like easy to pick up games and things that are very approachable. Do you think that actually comes from when you said before your family kind of wanted to join in on gaming with you? And so they wanted games that were easy to understand as well. And I think that's kind of like,
yeah,
the target audience is reflected in that too, which is really nice.
There's certainly a history there. You know, you've got to imagine that no matter what generation, they're growing up alongside games becoming more and more complex, right? Like, so my parents, you know, were born in the 50s, so like their first game experience of any kind would have been in the late 70s when they were already 29 to 30 years old. Like, you know, our age now, the first time they saw anything that resembled a video game, right? So it would have been odd. It's like us now trying to figure out TikTok. Like, it's just I'm guessing your ages. It's like me trying to figure out TikTok.
No, honestly, same here.
This guy is also trying to figure it out.
My first old moment was Snapchat. When it first came out, and I don't know what the rating is on this podcast, so I'll try to keep it PG-13. But yeah, so when it first came out, I mean, everybody's obvious use case for it was like dirty text, right? Like, because they won't be saved forever. So I can say something a little bit risque to my partner or person I'm dating, or I can send them maybe a slightly blue picture and it'll go bye-bye within a few seconds. And my first thing I said was like, don't screenshots just exist? Can't you just immediately like, what are you? And then the like 17-year-old or whoever was showing me, it was like, oh. And I was like, oh, I think I'm too old. It was just this instant moment where I clearly just didn't get it. And I just, whoo, right over my head. But anyway, I mean, that would have been my parents with games, right? It just like, what is this nonsense? Like beeps and boops and like the Atari, probably the first console I had, 2600. But my dad, you know, was a barber. So, I mean, he'd go to a pub after work kind of thing, and they had a sit-down Pac-Man table, so he was at least, like, passively familiar with, like, Pac-Man. So that was the first game I ever played, is that crappy Atari Pac-Man port. Yeah, and then Miss Pac-Man later, much better game, both in the arcade and on the console, to be honest.
I played that, actually, for the first time at an event on, like, one of the old consoles. I was so bad at it, actually.
First video game I ever played. I was 2 years old. Remember, at the time, it was just a simple stick and one button, so you could really, like, it, you know. But now looking at that, you know, if I show my mom like a, I don't know, like a VR controller, like the two rings with the, and there's just so much bullshit to take care of. And there's so many gestural things that it anticipates that you already know, like pinching to bring in and, you know, spreading to zoom out that we're all very used to. That's sort of in knowledge that we've got because we do this all the time, right? But yeah, if I slap that on my mom now, it'd just be disorienting and overwhelming, right? Like, I mean, it was a struggle to get to the like 12 buttons that are on a Super Nintendo controller. So when you get up to the like 30 plus buttons and gestures that are on like a PS5 DualSense, it starts getting to just be this overwhelming interface before you even consider anything about the game. And so that there's always like a grow up piece. So playing with my kids now is a little different because I have this huge body of kind of knowledge to draw on, but like regular folks don't, right? Like, I mean, they might have played one or two game systems and they kind of vaguely have that idea. So we're hitting a lot of people in our adult demographic that played a lot in the early 90s that had like a Super Nintendo or whatever that they were very crazy into, but then have not played for like 10 years and then are like, oh, well, actually, I can probably pick this up. And actually, they're not on the platforms you'd think. We're picking them up on like Switch because their kids have one, or we're picking them up on like Stadia, believe it or not, or mobile phones, certainly, because they're already in people's pockets. It's about hitting our audience where they are. If you think of games as this sounds cheap, and I don't mean this to be controversial, but I certainly think games are art. I very much do. But I don't like to think about them as an art product. So let me explain. Art as a concept, like just art, true art, is by its nature, when we say that word, kind of exclusionary and a little bit difficult, right? So you think about like the Louvre or you know, the Met. These places are expensive. They reflect a certain class of people. I'm making like air quotes. You know, they require a certain degree of what I would call like super literacy. So not only do you need to be literate as in read the language, but then you also need this additional complex literacy of being able to like peel apart the onion layers of things in terms of art. Otherwise, it's like, oh, Mona Lisa. Yeah. A half-assed picture of a lady. Like, it doesn't, you don't get the, you know, without that extra literacy layer. And so art has all of these things. Like, you need to almost like prepare for a trip to the Louvre, right? Like, I mean, there's like I'm going to see this. I'm going to see that. I'm going to, you know, study that. And so art by its nature is difficult. It's bracing and it's complex and it asks you questions about society and it's like super important and all of those things. But it's also difficult, right? It's not, it's a mushroom trip. You need to prepare. Like, this is going to be a thing that's going to change you, you know, and that's kind of its purpose, art. And that's very intimidating and bracing, right? So I like to think sometimes of games as like entertainment, like someone playing live music at a bar. Because of that approachability, like, you can still have those art moments in setups that are more casual and approachable. And I don't think that necessarily means we need to relegate everything to just being like a Candy Crush-esque kind of dopamine simulator with just lots and lots of flashing lights. I think you can still have meaningful experiences that can be more approachable. And so that's the piece of art I try to pull out of our definitions of what we do with games is that kind of heady, like, you can't get into this unless you really already know games. And we really just want anybody to be able to pick up a Nintendo Switch, possibly for the first time, start our game and have fun quick. Like, yeah. We even try to get you from press start to fun as fast as humanly possible. So it's all about just ease of entry.
Yeah, I agree. It's like, if there's so many different steps between actually booting up the game to then understanding what's going on and even having a clue about like maybe where the story is going, or even if there is a story, the less likely I am to actually continue with it. And it's, yeah, I like
it. Depends on the game, you know, certainly.
It does depend on the game, yeah.
I also want to be clear that just because these are the games we publish, it doesn't mean I don't like,
of course,
complex games myself, right? Like, there's a whole, nobody is like a monotone person, at least I hope not. And so, you know, you find lots of different places to have fun. I would say the game I play the most is probably Kerbal Space Program, which is a little odd for someone who wants approachability, because that's maybe the least approachable game in the universe.
So complex. So good though.
like it's extremely difficult and also requires like a super, super, super literacy. It's like, oh, no wonder this didn't fly. You just literally didn't do the rocket physics correctly. And, oh, yeah, all right, great. You know, and so these kinds of, it's obviously heady, but that one does the type of learning that we talk about as like experimental or experiential learning, where the like all the explosions and stuff are trivial and it doesn't like meaningfully alter the game and whatnot. So if you, it's funny because if you give Kerbal Space Program to an adult, they can get very salty and gamery about it. Like, oh, I needed 30% more Delta V to get to Mars. You know, these very like kind of gamer moments. But if you give it to a little toddler, they're just like, hey, I blew these guys to pieces. Woo! And they're just having fun. And all the little guys are sort of like got little like bumps on their heads. And it's all very cute and quaint. You know, nobody challengers in the sky or anything. There's no tragedy. It's all just very like, whoop, Jebediah blew up again. And then mysteriously 2 weeks later, he shows up back for work, and, you know, with a Band-Aid on. But yeah, so it, like it works out. It's nice. But it, the different kinds of approach is important. So you think about the different kinds of audiences you're serving, because, you know, young kids tend to be willing to experiment, willing to screw around. And so I think that's one of the ways we've ended up with bad onboarding is that, you know, really games in North America found their audience with children in the 90s, right? Like children, not teenagers. These were not teenage toys. They were like 13-year-old boys, yeah, by and large. And if you go look at ads in the United States and Canada in the 90s, that's obvious, right? It's like boogers and boobies, like, mm-hmm, is pretty much what you get. And it's very clearly aimed at like a juvenile male demographic. And so, you know, now 30 years hence, we're kind of left with the seeds we sowed. Right? And so it's, you know, I think aiming at kids is easy because they're willing to tolerate bad onboarding, right? Because they're kids. Everything in their life is bad onboarding. First time you hold a fork, there's no onboarding, right? And so because that's the kind of learning they're used to, approaching it's quite easy. Adults have very different kinds of sort of cognitive structures. So if you give someone, like if I gave you a teacup with a handle on the opposite side you're used to, or a teapot backward to what you're used to, it'd be very strange. And you'd have these kind of moments of like cognitive dissonance, whereas a little kid, no problem. And so I think going to a place where we think meaningfully about the onboarding process, I mean, we are, to my knowledge, the only publisher that has a full-time usability person that just literally does UX and onboarding for every single one of our titles. And that's a big part of what we try to do here. She also does accessibility, so things like people with disabilities, low vision, cognitive impairments, and whatnot, make certain that they can read, play, and participate in our titles as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really important important part of inclusivity is the sort of age inclusivity and ability or knowledge inclusivity that potentially isn't talked about that much.
I was going to say, but music is a great analogy for me because music can... You can get something out of music that's additional to the enjoyment if you think about it seriously. You know, if you start thinking about time signatures or so forth. But generally speaking, pop music is just the same kind of 4-4 and the same like 6-chord progression. You know, there's a whole YouTube thing on this. But, you know, and you can seek complexity. So you can seek something very, you know, simple, like, you know, a little dance riff or whatever, or you can seek Rachmaninoff or something really complex. But regardless, even the most complex, if I just turn it on, anybody can listen and enjoy with like no skills, no literacy, no anything. It just simply sounds pleasant and is, you know, sonorous and harmonious and so forth. So games need, we talk, yeah, a lot about that in here, that games need that piece so that even if I'm not the primary player, the experience, like if I'm sitting on the couch with the person who is the primary player, the experience should be pleasant and unstressful. If I'm a person who doesn't play games, the experience should be pleasant and unstressful and so forth. So just keeping that music piece in mind that even an overhearer should enjoy it, like that's kind of a piece of our titles, is that anybody, you know, if it's like, oh, that's cool, and I instantly hand you that controller, like the effort level required to overhear something should be the effort level you're spending to pick it up and go.
I much prefer that as well because it's like, there's a lot of gatekeeping in the games community about games that have to stay difficult for literally no reason, mm-hmm, other than to make people feel more accomplished. And I'm just like, I get it. I get that you want to play a game that's really hard. And you can do that, but also allow people to enjoy it in an easy way and like not have to have that element of it as part of the experience, you know?
That's a second order effect of what we sometimes call identity marketing, where we market like an idea or a personhood instead of a product. So there's an old marketing saying that people don't buy products, they buy better versions of themselves, or better fantasy versions of themselves. So you don't buy a Fitbit because you want a Fitbit. You buy a Fitbit because you want to be fit, right? Like you're buying a desire mm-hmm. for a future state of yourself. And so that's that's a big part of identity marketing. That's the reason why you can buy a Hydro Flask for like $90, or you can buy any water bottle for like $1. And, you know, really what's different there is the identity marketing. Like the whole Hot Minute Visco trend was like the best thing that happened to them, because now there's an identity tied to their product. And so every marketer's dream situation is that people identify themselves as like a gamer or something similar. So if, you know, you see this even in the console war nonsense, right? Like if you identify yourself as a PlayStation person, as an Xbox person, whatever, I mean, that's great for PlayStation or great for Xbox and terrible for everybody else. And that's normally how these kinds of brand marketing works. Like there's still people out there that are like, this is a weird thing. I'm going to go on an aside here. This is like my Tinder date number one, like this person is not for me. If someone comes to the counter at the restaurant and they're like, oh yeah, I'll get a Coke. And they're like, we only have Pepsi. Is that okay? And they go, oh no. I'm like, oh, you are a strange human being. Instant red flag. Like, oh, you can even tell the difference between this crap. Like, it's just,
I mean, I'm not going to lie. Pepsi is way better, but I would never say, oh, I don't want that, because it's slightly, you know, like, it's just like, it's whatever, isn't it? Like, it's just.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a preference, sure. But if you have a preference in public, that's odd. I mean, it's like, is Coke okay? No, it's not. Like, what? It's the same thing. I mean, so there are differences, sure. But I mean, we're talking, that's like when someone has a preferred brand of bottled water. I'm kind of like, who hurt you? Anyway, my gag with all of this is that, you know, the gatekeeping is because of that. So if you have someone who has an identity for a long period of time, and then a totally new demographic of people jump into that identity, that feels very threatening. Hey, this was mine. You're very much, you revert to toddler mode, right? Like, that's my toy. And it's because your identity's threatened a little bit. And so, you know, I mean, you see this a lot in anytime women, people of color, are included in activities where they were previously excluded by mostly white straight dudes. You know, so, for example, like, oh, we can't have women on the hockey team. Then what am I going to talk about in the locker room? And it's like, well, maybe you shouldn't have been talking about that anyway, if you can't talk about it around everybody. But anyway, these kinds of gatekeeping-y things right. that you see as a reaction are because, you know, this was my identity. I put an identity around this. It became my so-called third space. It's not work. It's not home. It's my third thing where I can practice my identity. And then when you have this whole new demographic of people come in, I will say it's quite natural to be frightened by that, but we as cognitive thinking, rationalizing humans should feel that lizard brain moment of, oh, a new creature is in this room with me, I'm terrified, and then go, okay, wait, but actually there's nothing to be afraid of, and we should have an open dialogue and so forth. But that extra step requires active participation on the part of the people involved, and that is sometimes too much to ask, unfortunately. And so I prefer the direct action of being gay on Maine 365 days a year and forcing you to accept that we exist. That's tricky and a very long conversation. But I think I'm the good faith guy. I would like to think that most people who have a shitty reaction to a non-white, non-straight, non-male person suddenly in their game party are not inherently evil people. They're just not taking that extra step of going, okay, wait a minute. Actually, I need to rationalize and take a look at myself here. And they're also usually like 13. So there's a lot of like cognitive pieces there. When you see a 35-year-old man acting this way, no excuse in the universe. But I mean, just generally speaking, I like to assume good faith with people, that it's not active evil. It's just ignorance, because that gives us moments to be kind and teach and make people change their minds and learn and open, you know, everyone, me included. I mean, now as an adult, I mean, married to a woman, but very much not straight. But I mean, everyone has a toxic 13-year-old period. It just how that toxicity pops out is going to be different depending on your demographic. But everybody is, I'm looking forward to it with my three children.
I think that kind of way of thinking and standing up for people, but also sort of using it as a teaching moment is something that I have seen from Whitethorn. I mean, for example, looking at games like Apico, like Calico, where there has been hateful comments yep. made or reviews and that sort of thing. I've seen the way that it's handled on social media has been very coming at it from a teaching perspective, but also maintaining that it's absolutely not acceptable.
Correct. Yeah. So we try two angles with any kind of situation like that. I mean, number one is as calmly, and we try not to be nasty, but occasionally, when someone is putting SS flags and Nazi symbols in your stuff, it's like, yeah, okay, well, sometimes and I encourage people to walk away, take a deep breath, and not just immediately dive in, because 90% of the time it's just bait. Like, I mean, it's a troll putting it there for you to jump on it, you know? So I definitely encourage our community team and myself, everyone has to have these conversations with themselves occasionally, to not just absolutely pillory the person who, you know, leaves you a crappy, because I mean, that's the thing, is there's a power imbalance, right? Because I have to remind myself that probably the person leaving me a nasty Steam review with like some words they heard on TikTok are probably 12 years old, you know? And so me just grabbing them as a 36-year-old CEO and putting them on blast and nailing them to the cross is equally petty, right? Like it you know, so I have to try to remind both myself, customers, employees, hopefully the person leaving your crappy Steam review is like a 12-year-old child and has not gotten to the point where they have rational and will feel bad about this someday. But you know, when we find out that it's very actively not the case, like we get like 40-year-old YouTubers going off about like, oh, SJWs are ruining games, my gloves are off with those ones. I'm just like, blacklist them, don't send them keys, like bury them in the dumpster. Like at some point there's a part where you know, that doesn't necessarily help anymore. But we do try to take the two-prong approach of like, just like disciplining a toddler. Number one, hey, we're going to very clearly say that the thing you just did is completely not acceptable, and we're not in any way going to alter our behavior because of your comments. Two, we're going to try our best to follow up and be like, why is this making you so mad? Like, take a deep breath and think about it for a minute. And the two in question, Calico and Apico, are the most recent. Apico, as I understand it, and please bear with me, we do have 30 employees, 30 games, so I sometimes am a little bit nebulous on the details. But as I understand it, L made the characters in the game modeled, not exactly, but loosely after inspirations of real-life people. And so those real-life people, as it turns out, may not be straight or cisgendered, and that's okay, right? Like, just because, I mean, I like being male, and I like presenting as male, and I like those things, and I feel very comfortable in that, and I think the way I feel about my gender when I'm at a barbershop or when I'm smoking a cigar or whatever feels great, and it feels good for me, and I want other people to feel that, regardless of what equipment they were or were not born with. And so that piece of respect is just wanting a healthy, positive outcome for other people, which is just generally being a decent human being. You don't want to watch other people get hit by trucks. You don't want people to get cancer. You know, like, you just generally should want people to have okay outcomes in their lives, unless there's something deeply wrong with you, or unless they've personally hurt you in some way. But like, generally speaking, you know, when people are like, oh, I had a healthy baby, even if I don't know them, I'm like, oh, you know, great job, man. Good. Like, it's positive, right? Mm-hmm. And so that kind of gender euphoria that we sort of rarely talk about, you know, the kind of like, oh, it fits, like it feels good, it fits, you know, post-transition for some people or born for some people and so forth, is like, I think the important part that we're looking for with our gender identity, regardless, and our gender performance, whatever that might be. Anyway, so long story short, they're modeled after real human beings who maybe don't fit those categories. So they choose, in some cases, non-gender conforming or non-binary pronouns. So they... she for a person who you might assume was he, and so forth. And so because they're real human beings, or modeled after real human beings, L had the human decency to include their preferred pronouns in their titles. Well, anyway, that upset the sort of, you know, the AR-15 crowd, and they do tend to show up. So, but again, I really do want to stress to people that So this whole world is big, and it's got 8 billion and change people in it. And if you look hard enough, you're going to find people in here that are not exactly people that anyone would ever get along with. But I do want to stress that generally speaking, they're few and far between. It's just the internet does have a magnifying effect of the most vitriolic, the most toxic, the most nasty, because we click on them and we share them, right? And that self-serving virality, it's a bit like how mosquito bites themselves aren't necessarily terribly harmful. I mean, barring West Nile or something. But then most of the infection comes from our incessant inability to stop picking at it. That's really the issue here. You know, I try to stress to our folks that one nasty review, especially when it's way off, like, I mean, you know, racial slurs, da da da, like clearly not a review, just there to be hurtful. I mean, flag it, report it, walk away. Because generally speaking, any additional attention only makes the problem much worse. Because of the schoolyard piece where, you know, if you react to the bully, they're going to keep doing it, but also because of the algorithmic piece. So much of our lives now is dominated by feeds and algorithms that we don't even have clear insight into. The TV shows that you're recommended, the things you see on Twitter are all fed to you by something that thinks it knows you better than you know yourself. And so, you know, if you get mad, you're going to see more things that make you mad. So, like, when you click on that article that's like, oh, yeah, some guy in West Virginia decided to beat his children or whatever, you're going to get more articles like that, because that's you are an active participant when you click that thing. So I try to tell people that a click is a contract. Like, as soon as you've clicked on it, your algorithm is going to change. So unless you're really sure, maybe don't click mindlessly.
Yeah, it's interesting. You can definitely, like, curate your own feeds and stuff at this point as well, if you're careful enough about it. And if you, you know, if you see something that you don't like, there are options to be like, I don't want to see this again, or I don't want to see things like this again. You could use those. They're there to be used.
But Android has really good ones. If you swipe right, whatever, you end up on the, or I guess the, anyway, over, you end up on the kind of Google News feed. Yeah, and if it's just over here, I have a real habit of picking the scabs on school shootings because I have 3 children. So it's funny. It's like, not only are you victimized by the worry about, like, will my children get to see their 18th birthday, but then on top of that, you are a source of ad revenue for every website covering every shooting. So every click, every tap, every everything, you only get served more and more and more. And it's like, my God, there's so many. And it's like, yeah, there are a lot, but actually it's pretty static since the 90s. It's just you're looking at all of them now because you're being fed them as a profit motive.
Yeah, I mean, it's using that emotional attachment, isn't it, to be able to get to draw you in. And that's the same with anything. It's it's really predatory, and I don't like the way that, you know, the algorithms work these days.
Anger and sadness is a stronger predictor of engagement than joy. That's a really sad part about the human condition, is moments of joy tend to, how do I put this? It's like CBD that became popular because of the things it doesn't do, which I think is more marketing than anything. But most positive effects on your body and mind are really long term, whereas most negative effects on your body are really short term gratification. And that's by necessity. So That's by necessity. So if you think about, like, trauma experiences, like I'm going to get attacked by a bear in the historical, like, you know, evolution of man kind of situation, or some kind of predator, that should feel awful now so that you take action immediately. Positive things should tend to feel positive over a long period of time so that you keep doing them. But here's the trick. We can serve you negative experiences 10 times a minute now, right? Like, just shitty take, bad tweet, hot take, racial slur, bop, 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 bop. So now you can just hit that again and again and again and again. And it's just like negative, 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 negative. And you're mind is very good at reinforcing things it repeatedly does. Consider how you speak. You don't even have to think about the words. They just come out of your mouth, right? And so I find myself literally reaching for the phone at any time when it's just silent. And that worries me a bit. But not that I'm anti-screen. I mean, I work in video games. It's just the mechanism by which we're engaging isn't happiness. It's not joy. It's at best a chore, like a FOMO, like I'm worried about not seeing what people are talking about. And at worst, like actively biting a canker, like picking a scab, like you are just, oh, I wonder how bad that raid on Trump's house is going. Oh, I wonder how much he screwed up the country. Oh, and you're just like, you're biting it again and again and again. And you're sort of serving your own you know, kind of psychosis. And I not literal psychosis, but your own neuroticism particularities that you've developed as a result of that kind of constant bombardment of negativity. And that's actually one part of what we do here. I mean, we have a couple of spookier games, but I mean, even Witchwood is very pleasant, right? It's still spooky, but it's pleasant. And that's mm-hmm. I sound like a 1960s Christian missionary here, but I'm trying to like maybe not spread quite so much murder and mayhem. We've got, not that I mind it, we're overserved.
Yeah, there's plenty of that already in the industry. Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like, I love a good remake, don't get me wrong, like if it's something that needs to be remade, but there's more remakes than original games at this point, and it kind of makes me so sad because there's so much creativity within this industry that can make new things, and we're still like, oh, but what if we did like an eighth version of the same game?
I would, you know, Parasite Eve on the original PlayStation, I would burn down a building for a remake of that one. So, you know, Square Enix, if you're listening, that's not a threat, it's a promise.
but yeah, I mean, so I think a lot of what we've talked about already is the idea that games can be tools to kind of spread positivity and powerful messages and things. But do you kind of see games becoming that and being able to change people's perception of within society and actually have real effects on the world?
Games is tricky because very soon there won't be, you know, give it 20 years, and there won't be a soul alive who hasn't in some way engaged with a game. I mean, it's already pretty damn close. Like, we're talking 3 to 5 billion, depending on how you measure, people in this world that have in one way or another put their hands on something game-like. Casual game, web game, console, PC game, web, you know, browser, cloud titles. Like, billion, five with a B. And so, I mean, there's going to be a very, very, very soon coming, especially as cell and cloud technology becomes cheaper. We get better at like space-based internet, so everyone anywhere can have internet. I mean, once we get to that point where internet is a true utility, like water and electricity, and virtually important here, everyone on the planet has some access to that. At that point, games will be more ubiquitous than film and music. I mean, music is ubiquitous. Every human being has heard music of some kind. I don't know if we'll ever get there, because making music is as simple as picking up a drum and, you know, doing the thing. But certainly movies is the good one to benchmark against. Movies, the stage, like plays, theater. I think we're kind of almost there, but I think the lingering thing, ironically, is the thing that made the industry in the first place. So marijuana is a great one. It's becoming more acceptable socially in most of the world. It's becoming researched for medical purposes, for mental health issues and physical issues around the world. But the problem is, as it's growing up, it's having a hard time shaking off its adolescence. So for every serious implementation of something cannabis related to help somebody with seizure disorder, PTSD, whatever, you know, there's like a dragon penis shaped bong with like RIP 420 on it and whatnot. And it has this very like stupid juvenile sheen that it's having a hard time shaking. And so, I mean, even you see this, you'll walk into like a medical dispensary that looks very, very, very like austere and medical and whatnot. And it'll be like, okay, we have 300 milligrams of Girl Scout cookies. And it's just all these like very stupid names that are. So games has the same trouble. We have the potential to do something really interesting. In the last like 12 months, I mean, I've played a lot of stuff that's just like, I can't describe as anything but like beautiful. I mean, like Spiritfarer and Behind the Frame, yep, and The Artful Escape and XO1 and all of these really interesting, artistic, beautiful, well-rendered, gorgeous, musical, thoughtful things. You know, but then also it's like Marvel's Avengers 96, Thor's Vasectomy, and 5 minutes later there's like Call of Duty Shoot-a-Man games and all this. And so we are having a hard time as a form of entertainment shaking free from Monster Energy drink and drywall in our knuckles is basically the punchline. And I think the farther away from Mountain Dew and Doritos we can get, the better it'll be for all of us.
I think so, but I also think that there are huge strides being made. I mean, if you look at White Thorn's games, but also there are a lot of games that can be played in multiple ways. So, I mean, Minecraft is a really good example, or even Breath of the Wild. So I love that game. There are so many different ways you could play that game. And even my mum, who, like many people's mums, probably doesn't play games at all. I had her play it one time and she just like picked up an apple and then went to feed it to a horse. And that was fine. She was playing Breath of the Wild. Like, it was good.
You know, I want to be clear. I sound really salty on it. I don't, there's an old craft beer analogy I've always used. Beer in the U.S., and I mean, you know, as English, you sound English. If I'm not, I apologize if I got that wrong.
But as English
folks, American beer was a joke for 50 years, right? They'd be like, oh, you know, yellow garbage, whatnot. But then in the like early 2000s, the craft beer licensing became a thing. So anybody anywhere can, you know, as long as they're of age and whatnot, can have a brewery and make their own craft beer. And now it's the envy of the planet. And so that reversal, though, actually requires the crappy yellow beer to exist. So I was touring Sam Adams a few years ago and they said, you know, obviously we don't like yellow fizzy pissy beer here, but clearly somebody does because they sell a billion bottles a year. And if it didn't exist, we wouldn't exist. And so, while I am a little salty about like the 700th God of War coming out, like I can't even count anymore at this point, I'm also a bit like, if that didn't exist, neither would we. So there's like a, it's not like we need them to go away. We certainly don't. We just need, like with art, to develop our, I don't know who our Andy Warhol will be, to like let us know that art can be a magazine, it can be an advertisement, it can be the Mona Lisa, it can be, we haven't had our games industry Andy Warhol just yet. That has kind of shown us that like there are, you can do What Remains of Edith Finch, which is very art heavy, but you can also find art in Gears of War. And we haven't had that human yet. You know, and I'm happy to be wrong about that. It's just from my perspective.
No, yeah, I agree. I think it's interesting, and I think that's also like what is the most gratifying part of this job is seeing so many different people's relationships with games and how they're all connecting with each other, and how everyone's story about how they, you know, started loving video games is slightly different, and that's kind of what I want our community to be focused on is the individuality behind games and the individuality behind the people who make them. Because there's so much out there and it's really hard to, you know, break that stereotype that when you say I work in video games, people just think, oh, you're on Call of Duty, you're on Candy Crush. And it's like, not quite, but we'll get there. I think we'll get there.
People always said the Brad Pitt paradox, which I guess he's not as relevant now as he was when I was going to school. But I mean, still relevant. But the idea is, you know, you have this idea going in that you're going to be Leo DiCaprio or you're not going to make it at all. And the reality is there's like millions of people that work in film, like millions. And the alarming majority of them, you will never know their names. But they will make a family-sustaining, enjoyable, meaningful life from that career. So we always tried to disabuse people of that. But it's tricky with video games because the first knee jerk, you're right, is like, oh, did you make Minecraft? And it's like, no, I didn't. I get that a lot. Especially small town. Like we're in a city where there aren't really other game companies. It's not that small, about 500,000 or something. But regardless, it's of a size where we're pretty much the only game company. And these are common grocery store dentist conversations like, did you make World of Warcraft? Yeah, just me. I did it. Yep. All me. That's why I am a super billionaire and I came here in my helicopter. But like, no, I didn't.
I think that's kind of a perfect way to end it as well. I think we've gone through a lot. I'm like,
sure.
I'm so ready to keep on this conversation, but I know that you've got to go, but,
Oh, anytime. Listen, I'm thrilled to do these kinds of things. I love to just chit chat. You know, and obviously mental health is important to me. I'm a strong advocate for therapy for everybody. I wish everyone had a yearly checkup like they do with their bodies. You know, I've been in it myself for some time. I go once every 2-3 weeks. I have no like acute, severe anything, but I try to manage long-term anxiety and trauma. I'm still terrified of death and dying from my dad's death as a child. It's a big thing that I work on all the time. And I think everybody has bags that they carry that someone else could help them work on. And, you know, before they develop into a disorder that requires interventional therapy, you know, you can have preventative mental health therapy. You can have screening mental health therapy that keeps us at a place where we're not just putting out fires. You know, there was a tweet that went around that I thought really nailed it that said, being a therapist right now is like handing glasses of water to people who are on fire, you know, and it very much like it, you know, and we've waited so long, right? Like, we're sort of reaping what we've sown with regard to mental health right now, I think, in that people have lived 20, 30, 50, 80 years without so much as a single checkup on like, hey, how you doing? Like really, like at night when the door's closed, how are you doing? And it's an open question. And so much of what we peddle to people over here really is like bisexual, pastoral, millennial escapism. And I mean, if that is something, you know, like having two characters kiss in the forest makes you kind of have a moment that helps you decompress, I mean, we're thrilled to have, yeah. We're thrilled to provide that.
I just wanted to say that, like, you don't have to be in crisis to go to therapy. I just wish that was more normalized and that people are allowed to explore themselves in a safe way in therapy and not have to think that, you know, you have to be having the worst time of your life to be able to go. But unfortunately, it's just not that accessible everywhere at the moment. And I'm hoping that we'll see a change in that. But
I think people believe they're more in tune with their mind than they really are. Your brain is really in the interest of maintaining stability. It's not, it has no interest in giving you reality. Consider the fact that both of your eyeballs have like a half inch sized optic nerve blind spot in them that you don't see because your mind thinks that that would be distracting. So it just decides not to show it to you. There's so much that your brain just goes, nope, you're not dealing with that, and literally corrects reality for you without your conscious knowledge of it having done that. So I believe people think, well, I'm in my head. Obviously, I know what's in here. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think it's about as stupid as saying, like, well, I'm not going to go to the doctor. If I had high blood pressure, I'd know about it. Yeah, you would once it's killing you. Like, you know, if you wait until it's a stroke, yes, you'll know about it. But ideally, we catch it before that happens. So, yeah, I don't think you need to wait until you're just gibbering in a bathroom at work to finally say, like, you know, maybe it's time to talk to somebody. But unfortunately, for many of us, that's kind of our first encounter with the mental health system, myself very much included, is when you just have a total meltdown and are just like, what is happening with my mind? And then you end up speaking with a professional. But like with medical issues, there's really no reason to ignore fainting until you're in a coma, right? Like, there's an old like Futurama line. It's like, sir, it's an emergency. And it's like, call me when it's a catastrophe, you know? And it's like, there's no need to wait this long.
It's always the way, isn't it? Well, thank you, Arthur. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been so lovely chatting.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Safe Space. If you're struggling, please know that there is support out there. And if you're looking for somewhere to start, please do visit our website at safeinourworld.org for a list of global helplines, information and support. You can also find us on all of the social medias at Safe in Our World if you'd like to follow the charity in our future endeavours. Thanks for listening and we'll see you next time.